Good afternoon. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons, and welcome to Afternoon Magazine. It's my great pleasure today to have as our guest for the hour, author Tracy Kidder, who will discuss his new work of nonfiction, Strength and What Remains. And hopefully we can talk about the craft of writing as well. As a way of introducing Mr. Kidder, I want to read a short bio from Literary Journalism, a collection of nonfiction pieces by American masters of the craft, of which Mr. Kidder is a charter member. Tracy Kidder served 10 years as a staff writer at The Atlantic, doing profiles, analytical articles, and scientific pieces. One day, his editor, Richard Todd, suggested he get in touch with one of Todd's college acquaintances, who was the head of a computer design team at Data General in Boston. Kidder found the project worth more than an article. He spent months watching day and night as the team built a new computer in their basement offices. The resulting book, The Soul of a New Machine, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1982 for nonfiction. Since then, Kidder's books have focused on people creating things. In 1985, he published House. In it, he watched a carpentry crew building a house, a mundane activity, but one full of skill and financial risk. In 1989, Among School Children chronicled a year in the life of a fifth-grade teacher and her class in Massachusetts, a district with a mixed ethnic population and a depressed economy. Kidder says that writing magazine articles produced a smattering of portraits of characters representing various categories or types. Now writing books, he can concentrate on sustained narrative. You end up with the same people you started with, and you've gone somewhere with them, he says. I have reviewed two of Mr. Kidder's books, favorably, I must confess, the one we'll discuss today, Strength and What Remains, and a previous book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, a man who would cure the world. By the way, Mountains Beyond Mountains was a book sent to all incoming freshmen last year here at the University of Illinois as part of our One Book, One Campus program. So Mr. Kidder is not a stranger to the Illinois campus. And there's a nice convergence between the two books, as we will discuss later. Strength and What Remains, A Journey of Remembrance and Forgetting, was published by Random House this fall. It's sure to be another Kidder classic. Publishers Weekly in its Starred review said the following: Kidder renders his subject with deep yet unfussy fidelity and the conflict with detail and nuance. It enables one to walk in the footsteps of its singular subject and see worlds new and old afresh. This profoundly gripping, hopeful, and crucial testament is a work of the utmost skill, sympathy, and moral clarity. Ron Suskind, writing in the New York Times, said the book is stunning. Mr. Kidder has worked relentlessly to carry on the tradition of John McPhee, sublimating ego in a tireless search for somewhere to hide, for a subject into which to vanish and live, sometimes for years. Few have been better at this than Kidder. He writes books illuminated by glowing humanism. To give you a quick and inadequate summary of Strength and What Remains, the book expertly weaves young African Deo's life at the bottom of the pecking order in the United States with his former life as a barefoot son of a Tutsi peasant farmer and herdsman, and then as a third-year medical student whose studies are dramatically cut short as Burundi and the neighboring Rwanda erupt into ethnic butchery. In Kidder's words, when Deo landed in New York City, he carried $200. He did not speak English. He did not know a soul in the United States. He had no prospects of employment. He did not know a soul in the United States. And yet in a matter of months, Deo had enrolled at Columbia University. We, of course, welcome your calls, 333-9455, and also if you're out of the area, 1-800-222-9455. Tracy Kidder, welcome to Afternoon Magazine.
Well, thank you.
And you said I could call you Tracy, and I will do. You can call me Stephen.
Okay.
Who is Deo, and how did you come to meet him?
Your description is pretty accurate. He comes from the small East Central African nation of Burundi. He's now an American citizen. Let's see. I met him. I had gone to see Paul Farmer, who was the subject of Mountains Beyond Mountains, the main subject anyway. Back in around the time when I'd finished that book, my wife and I had gone to visit him, and he had an operation on his knee, and Deo was there. And during that time, I spent most of the time talking to Paul, and my wife spoke with Deo. And on the way back, she told me what she remembered of the fragment of the life story he had told her, and I thought, gosh, that's pretty dramatic. And I kind of filed it away until I was looking around desperately for the next thing to do. and I thought I should go hear the story for myself. He's a remarkable person, you know, who, although at the outset of this story, he's not all that different from the rest of us. I like to think that, you know, looking at his story, escape first from civil war, then from genocide in Rwanda, and then somehow navigating New York City, you know, aided enormously by the kindness of strangers. And actually, it was a little less than 2 years before, after landing in New York, that he was at Columbia. You know, I sort of asked myself, well, how would I have fared, you know? And my answer, really, my honest one is, I wouldn't have survived. Nor am I likely to have done what he's done since then, which was, you know, now that he's an American citizen, he is essentially kind of, he had essentially deferred his medical education and gone on to back to Burundi to start a clinic and public health system with a lot of help from Paul Farmer and Partners in Health, but a wonderful enterprise in a country that's been shattered by, you know, 13 years of civil war, an organization called Village Health Works.
I'm fascinated by a conversation you had with Dale when you returned to Burundi with him. He's telling you about a concept, Gusimbura,
yeah.
I believe it is, the idea that you don't speak about people who die, that
yeah.
you are reminding people, and Dale says it's hard to understand because in the Western world, and you say people try to remember, and he says, yes, people in Burundi try to forget. Did this concept make it difficult for you to have Dale remember his past, his relatives? I mean, as a writer, was that a difficult fence
well,
to climb?
After he had told me his story, the outlines of it anyway, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, this is a story I think I'd like to try to tell. And I asked him if he would be willing, and I really tried not to put any pressure on him. You know, after a long time of thinking about it, I guess, you know, a pretty long time, some months, he decided he would. And I must say, you know, even though it was at times very difficult for him to do this, he followed through. I suppose just sheer ignorance, I didn't realize how difficult it would be. And, you know, there were a few moments when I think a couple times when I offered to stop, but he didn't take me up on that. I guess I'm glad of that now.
Also, later in the book, and I don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but one colleague of Deo's says that he has no skin. Everything just penetrates so much.
Yeah.
What does she mean by this?
Such a terribly sensitive guy, you know. I mean, he carries the burden of terrible memories, mm-hmm. and I think those do haunt him to some degree. I think that comes from the medical director of Partners in Health, who a wonderful woman named Joya Mukherjee. But she was speaking about him some years ago. I don't think that's quite so true now, although he is a very, and I think probably always was, a pretty sensitive soul, you know, tremendously compassionate, even before all of this stuff happened, and, you know, perhaps a rather emotional guy, but also a very charismatic fellow. I mean, he can get people to follow him around. But, I think she just meant that, you know, he was at that time. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem, Stephen, does that make sense?
Oh, yes, very much so. Let's go back to the story, more of the linear story here. In 1994, again, when he was 24, he made it to New York City under the guise of a coffee salesman, though he was never really
yeah.
challenged there. Why did he go to the United States, and what was he looking for, and how the heck did he get there?
He was just trying to get out of Burundi. I mean, most of the people he knew in medical school, or many of them, were leaving, and he thought that his entire family was dead, and I think, you know, he just thought, I want to leave. And I guess he had a very close friend from medical school who had a European father who paid his way and helped him get a visa. Deo didn't have a clue as to what the United States was. I mean, in Burundi they have a word, Iburaya, which means, you know, usually means Europe, or and usually France or Belgium having been its colonial master. But Iburaya could really mean any place that's far away and hard to understand. So he really didn't know where he was going. The plane was an Aeroflot flight, and he made many stops. He He actually got off in Shannon, Ireland, thinking he was in New York. But I think he was just traveling to get away.
In the United States, he meets some guardian angels, but he earned an incredible $15 a day delivering groceries in New York City. And somewhere in one of your recent interviews, you commented on the amount of African immigrants working in these menial jobs. Is this a common wage? And
I don't think so anymore. I mean, there was a lawsuit about that, that particular grocery chain. I have all the documents. I can't remember all the details now, but there's certainly, you know, they were playing... You can't do it legally, pay below the minimum wage like that. I don't know. I mean, I haven't done any of the research to know whether it's still going on. But there are a lot of, you know, immigrants who are delivering groceries and the like in New York. One of the, and I dare say in other cities, I sort of think, you know, after hearing this story, it would be impossible to look at anonymous faces in quite the same way ever again, you know. Particularly people with foreign accents. Who are they really, these people who are the maids or the janitors or the grocery delivery people? You know, who are they really? Where do they come from? Why are they here? You know, and what abilities do they have they'll probably never get to use?
He slept in some unusual and vulnerable places, including Central Park.
Right.
And at one point, you say that Dale believed that New York City made you feel like you were simply not a human being. In fact, in your book, you say, not long ago, he had been a student so accomplished he'd been offered a scholarship to a college in Belgium. Not long ago, he'd been a medical student at the top of his class. And here I am, he thought, being treated as someone who has a primate brain. God, he said silently, take my life.
Yeah. Well, he did get pretty close to despair during that time of living in first in abandoned tenements in Harlem and then in Central Park and doing a menial job that... you know, that's, it wasn't so much that it was beneath his dignity, but he wasn't getting to use his mind. And, you know, and he was in a kind of enforced isolation, silence, speaking only French. And although, you know, he started working at it pretty quickly, he would go into bookstores and libraries. He'd take out books in English and turn the pages, imagining himself reading them. He'd study dictionaries. It was pretty awful, pretty dreadful for him for some time there.
His time in New York City is full of chance encounters with, I guess for a better word, guardian angels.
Yeah.
And right away, right when he lands at Kennedy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, these things kept happening to him. They happened to him at the at a border crossing, and crossing from Burundi to Rwanda, where he probably would have been killed if it hadn't been for a woman of the opposite ethnic group from him, as it happens, who said, you know, who told him, trying to calm his fears when she came upon him, I'm a woman and a mother first. That's my uboko, my ethnicity. And then at JFK, he couldn't speak any English, so the immigration agents beckoned over a baggage handler, a guy who came from Senegal, who did speak French, and he helped Dale get through immigration. Mind you, this was before 9/11, well before 94, and who took him home. But home wasn't great. Home was an abandoned tenement in Harlem because the baggage handler was just trying to earn money in the States to bring home.
Tell me about Sharon McKenna. She's a key figure in Dale's survival and getting him, you know, eventually into Columbia. Who is she, and why did she take on Dale's plight?
I laugh because I've never enjoyed writing about anyone more than Sharon. She's an ex-contemplative nun who works at a little small Upper East Side Catholic church, whose main sort of self-appointed jobs is to help whoever comes there in need. Benedictine doorkeeper. She took a big interest in Dale. She speaks a little French, and she pretty quickly started helping him, first to get to see a doctor because he was feeling very sick. And he would come to see her. Sometimes he felt almost consternation at how much effort she was making on his behalf, almost more than he wanted. But she just didn't give up. She was relentless. She decided he needed a family, and she set out to find one. She's a woman in her, I guess now in her 60s, a woman with a sort of ethereal beauty, just physically. I don't know. You know, I'm not a religious person, but if there is such a thing as a holy person, I think she is. She is that person, one of them. She eventually did find a family for him, and they're also remarkable, although, you know, but more like the rest of us, I would say. You know, neither young nor rich. The woman, Nancy, is an artist, very interesting artist. Her husband, Charlie, is a sociologist, or as he called himself, described himself, a reformed academic. And Charlie and Nancy, after, you know, a sort of normal, sane amount of hesitation, I mean, I should add that they had they'd spent quite a good lot of time in Nigeria and were very interested in Africa generally, but they decided to take him in. I mean, a tremendous gamble, really, if you think about it. You know, here's a guy who, with no visible means of support, who might have become a burden on them for the rest of their lives. They took him in. They certainly don't regret it. And they paid his way to ESL, you know, at Columbia, and helped to pay his way to for his 4 years at Columbia University as a student.
I want to remind callers of our phone number. It's 333-9455 if you're local. If you're out of the area, it's 1-800-222-9455, and we're talking with Tracy Kidder. How was Deo able to get into Columbia University with such limited English skills?
Well, he was able to get some friends to... Well, by then, you know, I mean, he went to that ESL school. He's a quick study. He'd been working on English on his own, and... I can't answer it entirely since this, but he had done very well in schooling in Burundi, and he was able, although it was a little difficult to get his records from medical school there. Medical school had him listed as deceased, but he did get the records, and he took, I think they were a series of placement exams, and he aced them, you know, things like calculus. So, I guess it wasn't entirely smooth sailing, Columbia, but he did quite well overall.
I was fascinated that he actually received a threat while at Columbia, and I guess it was in 1996.
Worrisome.
Yes, but, yes. Yeah. Is that common?
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah.
I hope it never happens again. Mm-hmm. It hasn't to him, but. Yeah, he received a threat from an email, just an anonymous email from someone who claimed to be part of a rebel group in Burundi, and said that they were watching him and they could get at him anytime they wanted to. He took it to the dean. They traced it to some public computer, probably an internet cafe, and nothing ever came of it. Mm-hmm. But he pinned this email to the wall of his above his desk in his adoptive family's apartment, and I asked him why he did that, and he said, I told myself, you better get used to this.
Hmm. Now let's switch to another continent to the country of Burundi. Deo comes from a very rural life, obviously.
Yeah.
Tell me about his family and his upbringing.
Well, a large family, a large, loving family. I mean, he grew up in a thatched roof hut, essentially. He spent... He did go to school from... You know, elementary school on, and he did very well. He did probably have some advantages over, say, Hutu children who were grossly discriminated against during those years, but he wasn't of the right Tutsi group. He had no special connections or anything like that. He just did very well in school. Meanwhile, whenever he had free time, he was herding cows or carrying food and these amazing treks through. Burundi's a very mountainous country. Through the mountains to cow herders. It was a childhood with a lot of toil, no shoes until high school, but I think a childhood we tend to remember our childhoods fondly, most of us, I think, but you know, it seemed to and it wasn't all easy and simple. It was tough, but he had a wonderfully, and still does, wonderfully strong mother, and you know, family is a very important thing in that culture, as it is in so many others.
What happened on October 22nd, 1993, in Burundi, where he was in his third year as a medical student?
Well, Burundi, after colonialism, what had been a social difference, but not perhaps even the most important one, this so-called ethnic difference between Hutus and Tutsis, had been grossly exaggerated by the colonial government for its own benefit, a sort of divide and rule, or, you know, for the sake of being able to administer the country cheaply. And perhaps out of, you know, sort of lunatic racist prejudice, but much too complicated to explain right now. But the country had the opposite of what had happened in Rwanda had happened in Burundi, and a small military government had taken over of Tutsis, of a certain caste of Tutsis. And they had ruled the country for ever really since independence. Well, not right. Anyway, essentially during Deo's childhood, they'd ruled it. And there had been a number of uprisings, rebel uprisings, rebellions that were then put, and some of those were disgusting and bloody and brutal, but they were put down with even greater ferocity by the army. And you had a tremendous bloodbath back to when Deo was about 2 years old that had led to a terrible reprisal that really was what some historians have called a selective genocide. So finally, in the early 90s, there were elections, free and fair elections, internationally monitored. A man of peace, I'm told, was elected, and he was assassinated not very long afterward on the night of the 22nd of October of 93. And the next morning, all hell broke loose. And Deo got caught in this maelstrom of history, and he was working as a sort of intern in a large but a rural hospital, and militiamen attacked the hospital, and he escaped only because when he ran into his room to hide under his bed, he forgot to close his door, and they assumed that he had run away, mm-hmm. but they didn't check, and then. When that was over, the massacre in the hospital, he crept out into the night into a valley, and then for 6 months was on the run.
Mm-hmm. That section, Tracy, is just riveting when you describe him laying under his bed, covering his ears with his hands, and he could hear the noises of people being killed and crashes and all kinds of mm-hmm. smashing of glass. How did you get to that story?
I asked him about it, and, you know, we talked many, many times, as you might imagine, mm-hmm. and I would go back over some of the same ground and try to get more details. The way I did this, Stephen, was when I, you know, came to trying to assemble this book, and I do that usually by trial and error, that is, I rewrite a lot, I realized that I didn't want to tromp all over this story that Deo had told me. That is, I really had to tell this story. This story is based almost entirely on memories of his, and what I could verify, I did verify, but most of it couldn't be verified. I'm absolutely convinced that it's in its essentials true. I did go back over ground with him to tease out details here and there, but I tried to tell that story without embellishment. And I tell it more, you know, in the third person. I then turn in the second part of this book to the first person, something I thought was, by my light, sort of daring to do, but, you know, maybe even inadvisable, though I think it works. Partly I did that so that I could openly acknowledge to the reader that that first part of the story was based on entirely on memories. And memory is, of course, not, you know, when you come to wanting absolute factual accuracy, you can't rely solely on memory. I did it for other reasons as well.
Did you use a tape recorder?
I did in this case. I'd never used a tape recorder so extensively as I did this time. And that was in part because Deo preferred that I do it that way.
Why is that?
He didn't want me taking notes openly when we were in Rwanda and Burundi.
I see.
It made him uncomfortable, I think.
So, and I gathered from the book he still felt unsafe. And in fact, it was just a quirk of luck that he didn't die on one of his return trips.
Right. Well, that was still the war. The Civil War was still going on. When we went back, the war was essentially over. Mm-hmm. I don't think he felt unsafe. I think he felt wary and careful. And I think, the peace in Burundi, one hopes it will last forever. But it's still fragile. You can't have 13 years of hideous civil war and hundreds of thousands of people killed without and expect that, in a matter of a year, a couple of years, everything's going to be just fine and dandy. So, I think I never felt that his cautiousness was excessive.
What do I want to ask here? The idea, how does he end up with Paul Farmer? Because that makes such a nice a bridge to that book as well.
I think that was really his great good luck. I mean, he had an awful lot of bad luck, but he had some really good luck too. Sharon and Nancy and Charlie and the Mohammed, the baggage handler. But he had, and it was also, he loves libraries, and he loved them even then, and he was prowling the stacks of Baker Library at Columbia and came across a book of Paul Farmer's called Infections and Inequalities. He took it down off the shelf and started reading, and he says that within a few pages, he said, this is all about me, even though it was largely about Haiti and Peru. But it was all about, poor people dying of preventable and curable illnesses. And he then, I think, read everything he could find of Paul Farmer's, and he went after Columbia up to the Harvard School of Public Health to study and saw an ad for a speech that Dr. Farmer was giving and made an extravagant purchase for him. He had left his own copy of Infections and Inequalities back in New York, and he bought another one so he could get Farmer to sign it, went to the lecture and did that, and also asked if he could have Paul's email, which Paul gave him, and immediately Dale sent him an email, and within an hour, Paul had written him back saying, come and see me. He was right there at Harvard, and he spent the night talking. It was, and from then on, then Dale, went to work for the organization Partners in Health for a number of years, doing research. And I think it was a godsend for him. He felt somehow liberated. At last, there were people he really could talk to, whom he believed could understand what he had gone through and how he had grown up. And he was able to tell his story at long last in full, both to Paul Farmer and to the woman who is now the medical director of Partners in Health.
Mm-hmm. And he establishes eventually Village Health Works.
Yes.
in Burundi. And unlike our own country, everyone who visits the clinic sees a doctor or nurse for free, and 99% of the village population is Hutu, which is fascinating in itself. And
right.
I remember they had this wonderful story that one day a woman approaches Deo and apologizes for what he suspects is a past act of violence against his family, many of whom were killed. Deo tells her, what happened. Let's work on the clinic. Let's put this tragedy behind us, because remembering is not going to benefit anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is an extraordinary act of his, this creation of Village Health Works. And I think, Paul Farmer, through his once Dale had really resolved to do it, Paul and his other friends at Partners in Health threw their weight behind it as well. But Dale raised his legions of American friends, and with their help, he raised the money to do it. People in Burundi now don't really talk about Hutus and Tutsis, and certainly not around the clinic. Nobody gives a damn, as near as I can tell, anyway, about that anymore. There's deep poverty in that country. I think the vast majority, except perhaps some entrepreneurs of violence, would really just as soon. They've had enough war. The clinic is tremendously popular, obviously, in its area. It treats everyone who can't pay for free. I should say, people have come from all over the country because Burundi's, as you would expect, its public facilities are horrendous right now. I mean, they haven't been rebuilt. Burundi's not getting as much international aid, say, as Rwanda. But, Rwanda's had a lot more time to recover. He, at one occasion, you know, people have come from places like Congo and Tanzania to Village Health Works, and a few people have come just to see the clinic, not because they were sick. And one of them, Deo asked one of them why he was there, and the man said, to see America. And when I heard that at first, I thought, that's a misconception for us Americans to live up to, maybe. But in fact, you know, I was listening to President Obama give his speech in Ghana not so long ago, and he was talking about African and American cooperation and, you know, mutual responsibility, which would be a new thing in international aid, it seems to me, coming from this country. And it seemed to me like what Deo had done with Village Health Works was to make a little paradigm in miniature of this. You know, what I find so moving about it is that here's a country torn apart by these artificial differences, and largely artificial differences, you know, between two groups of people. And here's a potential beginning of an antidote that, you know, is based on something that unites us all, which is, you know, our common vulnerability to illness and injury, our common hope for life, you know. I find it very moving. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not supposed to, but I do.
No, I found it moving reading it, too, believe me. We're speaking to Tracy Kidder, author of Strength and What Remains. Our phone number is 333-9455 if you're out of the area, 1-800-222-9455. What does Deo think of this book?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Exactly. I gave it to him. He's a very private person, and I don't expect really to hear that. I did go over some of it with him to check on its accuracy at the end of the entire process, but even that I think he found difficult to do. So I don't know.
Okay. We have a caller from Urbana. Caller, you have a question for Tracy Kidder?
Hey, good afternoon. I just finished this book just 2 days ago, and I wanted to say to anyone who's listening who hasn't read it, there's just the compelling story of this individual and of this part of the world, but it's also just so beautifully written, so compelling, and so humane and sensitive. So just my warmest compliments to you on what a great book it is. The one comment I wanted to make was one thing I found especially moving about the book was Deo's struggle with why such evil happens and why some people are capable of such inhumanity and some people are so capable of kindness and compassion in such extreme circumstances. And I wondered if you might just comment on that. I'll listen
sure.
to the air.
Yeah.
Thank you, caller.
You know, it's interesting to me that when Deo went to Columbia, you know, he majored in biochemistry, but he also does a second major in philosophy. And I, you know, the least marketable skill you could imagine for an immigrant. And I asked him why, and he said, I wanted to understand what had happened to me. And he was really referring to, I think, to the cosmic questions, that question of how can a neighbor take a machete and kill his friends and neighbors. And, you know, I'm afraid, you know, humanity's been asking that question for a long time. Philosophy opens those questions, but like most students of philosophy, or maybe all, Deo didn't get answers; he got more questions. And nevertheless, he had, you know, it was he had a peaceful place, a place where his mind could dwell on them. And you know, I think for him, I think what he discovered, I mean, he never exactly said this to me; I sort of infer it, is that that question which troubles him so deeply may not be answerable in a, you know, in any intellectual way, but sometimes the answer for a person, individual, lies in your hands. You know, you have to do something, and I think that, you know, creating this clinic, which I suspect is the beginning of a pretty what may well be a very distinguished career in public health and medicine. I think it, you know, it knitted his life back together. It brought the two parts of his life, you know, America and Burundi, back together for him. And I mean, interestingly, I think when he was a student in high school, he rallied some of his high school friends to try to help build a clinic in a village where he'd gone to school, a village, you know, beset without any medical facilities. He failed. He and his friends did. They tried three three summers in a row. But in a way, you know, it's like picking up life again. But Dale is like his friend and mentor, Paul Farmer. I think they, you know, an effective idealist, the kind of person who wants to build something larger than himself.
I remember something you wrote in Mountains Beyond Mountains about Paul Farmer. It's also a very moving book. Farmer loves to quote German pathologist Rudolf Virchow. Who once said, "The physicians are the natural attorneys of the poor, and the social problems should be largely solved by them." And Farmer, who maneuvers really outside of the domain of political geographies, likes to say, "We belong to the nation of those who care for the sick." This is almost a radical point of view, if you, in an American sense, and it seemed like Dale just works for Dale very well.
Right. I mean, I think there's a caveat to add to that, which is that it is radical, and I think it's bracing. You know, I mean, and one is I simply feel grateful that there are such people in the world. I mean, you know, in a world full of murder and mayhem, it's nice to know that there are some opposing forces there, effective opposing forces. But I do think it's worth pointing out that Partners in Health and Dale and Village HealthWorks have made every attempt to work, not so much politically, but to work with the ministries of health wherever they are. Because in the end, you know, these kinds of organizations can't confer rights on people. It has to be done through their governments. And also, you know, if you really want to do effective work in a country that needs and probably is owed some help from the richer countries, you've got to make sure your projects become indigenous. That is, you've got to be creating local expertise. I mean, you know, as Partners in Health has done in Haiti, and as Village HealthWorks is doing in Burundi now.
Mm-hmm. There's been incredible progress in Rwanda, the neighboring country, and the New Yorker reported recently that 15 years after the genocide, it's one of the safest, most orderly countries in Africa.
Yeah.
What about Burundi?
I wouldn't say, no, I don't think you could say that about Burundi now. I hope you will be able to soon. You know, you could stir up quite a huge debate over Rwanda and its politics at the moment, and I don't want to get into that because I don't fully understand it. But I think just, you know, superficial impressions going to the two countries, they're very, very different now. But to be fair, I mean, Rwanda has been recovering for, you know, since 94, and Burundi only since, well, depending on when you date the end of the Civil War, something like 2005 or so, that it's really had a chance to begin to recover. But it doesn't feel safe and orderly, not by any stretch of the imagination.
And certainly you convey that when you travel with him. There's a certain element of fear that comes out in your own reporting. How did it feel to be there?
Well, most of the time it felt fine. It was wonderful to be there with, you know, that great feeling of relief that you have when you're traveling in a place that's completely strange to you, with someone who really knows his way around. You know, Dale is forceful and he certainly knew his way around. What happened, though, was that we were visiting the stations of his life there. He was doing that for my benefit. Sometimes I felt as though the memories were like long-lived viruses or something, you know, and they were waiting for him in the locales, you know. There were times when it just seemed overwhelming, the flood of memories on him. And the worst time, actually, for me, I don't want to make this sound for a minute like this was hard for me. This is my job, you know, the only thing that was hard was, it was hard on him. But there was one occasion we went back to the hospital where his whole journey had really essentially begun. And there it was, and I just got tremendously spooked. I tried to write honestly about it. You know, I mean, I feel, in retrospect, sort of foolish because I don't think we were ever in any physical danger, but it just seemed so psychologically charged. I don't know what else to say about that.
Our caller sort of took a little bit of the question I wanted to ask, but I'm glad she did. But what conclusions have you come to regarding cruelty and compassion? I mean, these two human traits, they just run through the book, the worst and best of humanity. Did you come away from your reporting and working on this book? I think it was 6 years you worked on this? Or
3 years,
okay.
3 years, yeah.
What did you come away with? Did you learn any new conclusions?
It's hard for me to come to conclusions. It may just be my own deficiency. I guess, you know, I haven't solved the problems that the great philosophers have solved. But the way I guess I look at it is I'm a storyteller. And, this book is about war and genocide. It's about resilience. It's about the kindness of stranger, the torment of memory. But we know the basic truths about those things. What I guess I wanted was for you, for the reader, to experience them not as truisms, but as we experience them in our lives and through Dale. To make the world new again, sort of. I don't have any grand theories or conclusions. You know, except to say that, of course, those things exist. It's a deeply troubling world. I guess for me that this little journey of having my eyes open to the true state of a lot of the world anyway began with Paul Farmer. He showed me more reasons for despair than I had ever seen before or even imagined. I thought I was pretty worldly wise. It's a very powerful lens for looking at the world, the poor parts of the world, particularly that is the lens of public health and medicine. My journey with Farmer and my journeys with Dale were some of the most exhilarating experiences of my life, because to see what small groups of people were actually doing as a kind of antidote or an opposing force, instruments of peace. I'm not quite sure how to say it, but those aren't grand conclusions. It's just that, it is nice to know that the world isn't simple. Some people feel that, cynicism it misrepresents the world, is what I would say. It misrepresents it as fully as a Hallmark card could misrepresent it. It's just the logical opposite of sentimentality. There is goodness in the world, altruism, those things, and I'm glad that there is.
Is cynicism a Western point of view? I mean, did you find in Africa?
I don't think so.
Okay. I wanted to shift gears for a second and just, since we're talking to one of the masters of narrative nonfiction, to ask you a couple of questions about writing. And I've been saying this for years now that recently nonfiction by American authors is going through a sort of renaissance of sorts, especially on the narrative side, the type that you do and John McPhee has done for so long, and so many other even young writers coming along. Would you agree with that? Do you think nonfiction's at a good place right now?
I guess it is. I've gotten to the age now, Stephen, where I'm trying to make sure I read all the books before I die that I should read. So I haven't been reading as much contemporary stuff as I should. I do know that this kind of nonfiction, which doesn't really have a good name, which I think is kind of good, by the way, that it has a very long lineage and really could probably go back to Thucydides, the Peloponnesian Wars. But certainly in English, George Orwell was for me a great hero when I was first attempting to write in this vein. And John McPhee, of course, I think one of the most elegant writers alive in America today. There's just any number of really good writers out there doing this. I don't necessarily want to oppose it, though, to fiction, because there's a lot of good fiction being written, too. But I do think we're in a nice age, and I think it's been going on for some time. Certainly, there was always the mixture of good and bad stuff being written in the But starting in the 60s with the so-called new journalism, which wasn't, of course, new at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you dig around a little bit, you come across people like, and you don't have to dig too far to find Joseph Mitchell, who was writing this wonderful stuff for The New Yorker, or A.J. Liebling, one of my personal favorites,
yes.
Who isn't as well remembered as I think he ought to be. He's one of the funniest writers I've ever read. But, you know, we have writers now like Ian Fraser, who's just hilarious, but also very acute. And I don't know, any number of others, a young woman who is... Well, I guess she's not that young anymore. I'm so proud of having been her teacher just briefly anyway, Adrienne LeBlanc.
Oh, yes.
Book Random Family. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's a good period for this sort of thing. I do remember that early on when I was finding that I wasn't quite so inspired anymore to try to write fiction, a friend of mine said, you know, a writer friend named Sam Toporoff said that... the world is so interesting and strange, and it's hard to compete with the strangeness and interest of fact in fiction. He said, if I were a young man, I'd get a job, you know, writing for a newspaper or Time or Newsweek or writing, you know, nonfiction. And he probably forgot saying it about 30 seconds later. It stuck with me.
Well said. Well, thank you, Tracy Kidder, for talking about Strength and What Remains. It's an incredible book, and I wish you the best of luck with that in your future endeavors and projects. And I thank you, dear listeners. I'm Stephen Lyons.